Chapter 165. I am shown two interesting penitents, for a time at all events until my book should be completed, which would be the work of several months. I took up my abode in my aunt's house at Dover, and there, sitting in the window from which I had looked out at the moon upon the sea, when that roof first gave me shelter, I quietly pursued my task. In pursuance of my intention of referring to my own fictions, only when their course should incidentally connect itself with the progress of my story, I do not enter on the aspirations, the delights, anxieties, and triumphs of my art. That I truly devoted myself to it with my strongest earnestness, and bestowed upon it every energy of my soul, I have already said. If the books I have written be of any worth, they will supply the rest. I shall otherwise have written to poor purpose, and the rest will be of interest to no one. Occasionally, I went to London, to lose myself in the swarm of life there, or to consult with Traddles on some business point. He had managed for me, in my absence, with the soundest judgment, and my worldly affairs were prospering. As my notoriety began to bring upon me an enormous quantity of letters from people, of whom I had no knowledge chiefly about nothing, and extremely difficult to answer, I agreed with Traddles, to have my name painted upon his door. There, the devoted postman on that beat delivered bushels of letters for me, and there, at intervals, I labored through them, like a home secretary of state without the salary. Among this correspondence, there dropped in, every now and then, an obliging proposal from one of the numerous outsiders always lurking about the commons, to practice under cover of my name if I would take the necessary steps remaining, to make a proctor of myself, and pay me a percentage on the profits. But I declined these offers, being already aware that there were plenty of such covert practitioners in existence, and considering the commons quite bad enough, without my doing anything to make it worse. The girls had gone home, when my name burst into bloom on Traddles' door, and the sharp boy looked, all day, as if he had never heard of Sophie, shut up in a back room, glancing down from her work into a sooty little strip of garden with a pump in it. But there I always found her, the same bright housewife, often humming her Devonshire ballads, when no strange foot was coming up the stairs, and blunting the sharp boy in his official closet with melody. I wondered, at first, why I so often found Sophie writing in a copy book, and why she always shut it up when I appeared, and hurried it into the table drawer. But the secret soon came out. One day, Traddles, who had just come home through the drizzling sleet from court, took a paper out of his desk, and asked me what I thought of that handwriting. "Oh, don't, Tom!" cried Sophie, who was warming his slippers before the fire. "My dear," returned Tom, in a delighted state, "why not? What do you say to that writing, Copperfield? It's extraordinarily legal and formal," said one. "I don't think I ever saw such a stiff hand. Not like a lady's hand, is it?" said Traddles. "A lady's?" I repeated. "Bricks and mortar are more like a lady's hand." Traddles broke into a rapturous laugh, and informed me that it was Sophie's writing, that Sophie had vowed and declared he would need a copying clerk soon, and she would be that clerk, that she had acquired this hand from a pattern, and that she could throw off I forget how many folios an hour. Sophie was very much confused by my being told all this, and said that when Tom was made a judge he wouldn't be so ready to proclaim it, which Tom denied, averring that he should always be equally proud of it, under all circumstances. "What a thoroughly good and charming wife she is, my dear Traddles!" said I, when she had gone away, laughing. "My dear Copperfield," returned Traddles, "she is, without any exception, the dearest girl. The way she manages this place, her punctuality, domestic knowledge, economy, and order, her cheerfulness, Copperfield. Apostrophe, apostrophe, indeed, you have reason to commend her. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I returned. You are a happy fellow. I believe you make yourselves, and each other, two of the happiest people in the world. Apostrophe, I am sure we are two of the happiest people, apostrophe, returned Traddles. I admit that, at all events. Bless my soul, when I see her getting up by candlelight on these dark mornings, busying herself in the day's arrangements, going out to market before the clerks come into the inn, caring for no weather, devising the most capital little dinners out of the plainest materials, making puddings and pies, keeping everything in its right place, always so neat and ornamental herself, sitting up at night with me, if it's ever so late, sweet-tempered and encouraging always, and all for me, I positively sometimes can't believe it. Copperfield. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he was tender of the very slippers she had been warming, as he put them on, and stretched his feet enjoyingly upon the fender. I positively sometimes can't believe it, apostrophe, said Traddles. Then our pleasures. Dear me, they are inexpensive, but they are quite wonderful. When we are at home here, of an evening, and shut the outer door, and draw those curtains which she made, where could we be more snug? When it's fine, and we go out for a walk in the evening, the streets abound in enjoyment for us. We look into the glittering windows of the jewelers' shops, and I show Sophie which of the diamond-eyed serpents, coiled upon white satin rising grounds, I would give her, if I could afford it. And Sophie shows me which of the gold watches that are capped and jeweled and engine-turned, and possessed of the horizontal lever escape movement, and all sorts of things, she would buy for me, if she could afford it. And we pick out the spoons and forks, fish slices, butter knives, and sugar tongs, we should both prefer, if we could both afford it. And really we go away, as if we had got them. Then, when we stroll into the squares, and great streets, and see a house to let, sometimes we look up at it, and say, how would that do, if I was made a judge? And we parcel it out such a room for us, such rooms for the girls, and so forth, until we settle to our satisfaction, that it would do, or it wouldn't do, as the case may be. Sometimes, we go at half price to the pit of the theater, the very smell of which is cheap, in my opinion, at the money, and there we thoroughly enjoy the play, which Sophie believes every word of, and so do one. In walking home, perhaps we buy a little bit of something at a cook's shop, or a little lobster at the fishmonger's, and bring it here, and make a splendid supper, chatting about what we have seen. Now, you know, Copperfield, if I was Lord Chancellor, we couldn't do this. Apostrophe, apostrophe, you would do something, whatever you were, my dear Traddles, apostrophe, thought I, that would be pleasant and amiable. And by the way, apostrophe, I said aloud, I suppose you never draw any skeletons now? Apostrophe, apostrophe, really, apostrophe, replied Traddles, laughing, and reddening, I can't wholly deny that I do, my dear Copperfield. For being in one of the back rows of the King's Bench the other day, with a pen in my hand, the fancy came into my head, to try how I had preserved that accomplishment. And I am afraid there's a skeleton in a wig on the ledge of the desk. Apostrophe, after we had both laughed heartily, Traddles wound up by looking with a smile at the fire, and saying, in his forgiving way, old Creakle, apostrophe, apostrophe, I have a letter from that old rascal here, apostrophe, said one. For I never was less disposed to forgive him the way he used to batter Traddles, than when I saw Traddles so ready to forgive him himself. From Creakle the schoolmaster? Apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed Traddles. No. Apostrophe, among the persons who are attracted to me in my rising fame and fortune, apostrophe, said I, looking over my letters, and who discover that they were always much attached to me, is the self-same Creakle. He is not a schoolmaster now, Traddles. He is retired. He is a Middlesex magistrate. Apostrophe, I thought Traddles might be surprised to hear it, but he was not so at all. How do you suppose he comes to be a Middlesex magistrate? Apostrophe, apostrophe, said one. Oh dear me. Apostrophe apostrophe replied Traddles, it would be very difficult to answer that question. Perhaps he voted for somebody, or lent money to somebody, or bought something of somebody, or otherwise obliged somebody, or jobbed for somebody, who knew somebody who got the lieutenant of the county, to nominate him for the commission. Apostrophe, on the commission he is, at any rate, apostrophe said one. And he writes to me here, that he will be glad to show me, in operation, the only true system of prison discipline. The only unchallengeable way of making sincere and lasting converts and penitents, which, you know, is by solitary confinement. What do you say? Apostrophe, to the system? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired Traddles, looking grave. No. To my accepting the offer, and you're going with me? Apostrophe, I don't object, apostrophe said Traddles. Then I'll write to say so. You remember, to say nothing of our treatment, the same Creakle turning his son out of doors, I suppose, and the life he used to lead his wife and daughter? Apostrophe, apostrophe, perfectly, apostrophe said Traddles. Yet, if you will read his letter, you'll find he is the tenderest of men to prisoners convicted of the whole calendar of felonies, apostrophe said I. Though I can't find that his tenderness extends to any other class of created beings. Apostrophe, Traddles shrugged his shoulders, and was not at all surprised. I had not expected him to be, and was not surprised myself, or my observation of similar practical satires would have been but scanty. We arranged the time of our visit, and I wrote accordingly to Mr. Creakle that evening. On the appointed day, I think it was the next day, but no matter, Traddles and I repaired to the prison, where Mr. Creakle was powerful. It was an immense and solid building, erected at a vast expense. I could not help thinking, as we approached the gate, what an uproar would have been made in the country, if any deluded man had proposed to spend one half the money it had cost, on the erection of an industrial school for the young, or a house of refuge for the deserving old. In an office, that might have been on the ground floor of the Tower of Babel, it was so massively constructed, we were presented to our old schoolmaster, who was one of a group, composed of two or three of the busier sort of magistrates, and some visitors they had brought. He received me, like a man who had formed my mind in bygone years, and had always loved me tenderly. On my introducing Traddles, Mr. Creakle expressed, in like manner, but in an inferior degree, that he had always been Traddles' guide, philosopher, and friend. Our venerable instructor was a great deal older, and not improved in appearance. His face was as fiery as ever, his eyes were as small, and rather deeper set. The scanty, wet-looking gray hair, by which I remembered him, was almost gone, and the thick veins in his bald head were none the more agreeable to look at. After some conversation among these gentlemen, from which I might have supposed that there was nothing in the world to be legitimately taken into account but the supreme comfort of prisoners, at any expense, and nothing on the wide earth to be done outside prison doors, we began our inspection. It being then just dinner time, we went, first into the great kitchen, where every prisoner's dinner was in course of being set out separately, to be handed to him in his cell, with the regularity and precision of clockwork. I set aside, to Traddles, that I wondered whether it occurred to anybody that there was a striking contrast between these plentiful repasts of choice quality, and the dinners, not to say of paupers, but of soldiers, sailors, laborers, the great bulk of the honest, working community, of whom not one man in 500 ever dined half so well. But I learned that the system required high living, and, in short, to dispose of the system, once for all, I found that on that head, and on all others, the system put an end to all doubts, and disposed of all anomalies. Nobody appeared to have the least idea that there was any other system, but the system, to be considered. As we were going through some of the magnificent passages, I inquired of Mr. Creakle and his friends what were supposed to be the main advantages of this all-governing and universally overriding system. I found them to be the perfect isolation of prisoners, so that no one man in confinement there knew anything about another, and the reduction of prisoners to a wholesome state of mind, leading to sincere contrition and repentance. Now, it struck me, when we began to visit individuals in their cells, and to traverse the passages in which those cells were, and to have the manner of the going to chapel and so forth explained to us, that there was a strong probability of the prisoners knowing a good deal about each other, and of their carrying on a pretty complete system of intercourse. This, at the time I write, has been proved, I believe, to be the case, but, as it would have been flat blasphemy against the system to have hinted such a doubt then, I looked out for the penitents as diligently as I could. And here again, I had great misgivings. I found as prevalent a fashion in the form of the penitents, as I had left outside in the forms of the coats and waistcoats in the windows of the tailors' shops. I found a vast amount of profession, varying very little in character, varying very little, which I thought exceedingly suspicious, even in words. I found a great many foxes, disparaging whole vineyards of inaccessible grapes, but I found very few foxes whom I would have trusted within reach of a bunch. Above all, I found that the most professing men were the greatest objects of interest, and that their conceit, their vanity, their want of excitement, and their love of deception, which many of them possessed to an almost incredible extent, as their histories showed, all prompted to these professions, and were all gratified by them. However, I heard so repeatedly, in the course of our goings to and fro, of a certain number 27, who was the favorite, and who really appeared to be a model prisoner, that I resolved to suspend my judgment until I should see 27. 28, I understood, was also a bright particular star, but it was his misfortune to have his glory a little dimmed by the extraordinary luster of 27. I heard so much of 27, of his pious admonitions to everybody around him, and of the beautiful letters he constantly wrote to his mother, whom he seemed to consider in a very bad way, that I became quite impatient to see him. I had to restrain my impatience for some time, on account of 27 being reserved for a concluding effect. But, at last, we came to the door of his cell, and Mr. Creakle, looking through a little hole in it, reported to us, in a state of the greatest admiration, that he was reading a hymn book. There was such a rush of heads immediately, to see number 27 reading his hymn book, that the little hole was blocked up, 6 or 7 heads deep. To remedy this inconvenience, and give us an opportunity of conversing with 27 in all his purity, Mr. Creakle directed the door of the cell to be unlocked, and 27 to be invited out into the passage. This was done. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.